Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Co-authors Anthony and Christina Adams have written, produced, and developed film and television projects for many studios, including Disney, ABC, and CBS. Christina is a producer of the Emmy Award-winning series The Amazing Race and multiple programs for Oprah Winfrey. Anthony composed the music and lyrics for their theatrical project, Sideways the Musical. Anthony and Christina have written a novel under the name A.C. Adams. Their debut novel, Chasing Shadows, was inspired by true events. Christina's search to uncover her father's secrets. Anthony and Christina Adams, welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, great to be here.
Nice to be here.
Now, I didn't mention that you also had a couple of shows aired nationally on PBS. And what were those shows?
One was called Primal Twang, The Legacy of the Guitar. And it was a live music documentary in a theater with Grammy Award-winning guitar players from all genres, a scripted show with a narrator and projections. And it took the audience on a ride through the ancient ancestors of the guitar all the way up to the present in all styles, which was a wonderful experience for us. We filmed it and it aired nationally on PBS.
And you got a reward for it too, an award.
We did, the Rome International Film Festival. And the format was so successful that we also did one on the music of the 1960s called Love in a Musical Celebration, hosted by Tony Award-winning actor Ben Vereen. And we used the same technique, bringing in Grammy Award-winning stars, using projections and a script. And it was also a very successful show, which we filmed and also aired on PBS.
Well, I would like to get on now with your debut novel. And we don't know, as we're reading it, I'm sure you collaborated, the two of you, but there is one section that has Christina's name on it. And so I would like you, Christina, if you would, to read the author's note.
Sure. Chasing Shadows was inspired by the search to uncover my father's secrets. When he vanished, leaving an inscrutable message that revealed he had a new life and must never see his children again, my world was turned upside down. He was a brilliant university professor and a caring parent, almost a super dad who bought me and my siblings a horse, encouraged our interests, took us camping at all the national parks. I idolized him and needed to understand why he would leave us. Hoping to discover the truth, I embarked on an international search with my husband and writing partner, Anthony Lee Adams. What we learned about his hidden past changed everything I thought I knew about my family history. Although we interviewed many of my father's friends and colleagues, his labyrinthine life was a Gordian knot that was impossible to fully unravel. To protect our sources, their names have been changed, and we took creative license with several of the locations, but many of the events of his life and the details of our search are true. We hope you enjoy Chasing Shadows.
This is co-author Christina Adams reading a note about her book that she and her husband have written. And the whole time I was reading it, I thought, oh my goodness, I find this so hard to believe. And so I know some of it is true, is inspired. For example, your mother in the story, Sophia's mother. In fact, when I was reading your story, I had to keep saying, okay, this is Sophia. This is not Christina.
And it's not a memoir. It's inspired by actual events. And just like in the book, my mother was born in Italy. Her home was bombed in Sicily when the Allies invaded the island. And her family fled to Rome, which is where she met my father.
Yeah, for example, I'm reading, here's your mother, a POW? Your mother?
Yeah.
That part was hard to read. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was hard. It was hard on her, too.
I'm sure. Well, this book that we're reading, the setting, it's all a lot of different places it takes place. But when this story that you're writing now is taking place in 1978, is that the time that we're looking
1979.
At? 1979. So the first chapter is called Voices from the Past. And so, Anthony, I'm going to ask you to read this Voices from the Past about, and Christina, I'm going to say it's about your dad. I'm sure it's not his name, but it is about your dad, inspired by your dad's story. So, Anthony, would you read? Start reading chapter one?
Absolutely. Dr. Aidan Ryan felt the fateful ticking of the clock set in motion years ago, and although filled with dread, he embraced the momentous change rushing toward him like an unstoppable freight train. On a foggy June morning, he strode across the campus of El Encanto College, briefcase in hand, dressed in a navy blue linen sports coat, a collarless white shirt, and khakis. At 60, the tall, dynamic history professor possessed a charisma that led strangers to believe he was famous. He wasn't, but he looked the part and carried himself with the gait and vitality of a much younger man, outpacing his students on the walkways and racing up campus stairs, leaving them in the dust. A cool breeze blew through his blonde hair, streaked with silver, as he passed the Spanish colonial buildings of the esteemed private institution in San Diego, perched on a bluff overlooking the Pacific Ocean, where perfect sets of waves crashed against the rugged cliffs. Dr. Ryan passed through a courtyard shaded by towering Italian cypress trees and under a topiary arch into a quiet place he referred to as Magistral Garden because it reminded him of a miniature version of his favorite park in Italy. After settling on a stone bench next to a colorful Mexican-tiled fountain, he opened his case, pulled out his lecture notes, and began to write. Moments later, he heard footsteps approaching and turned to see his daughter, Sophia. The young woman, a luminous willowy blonde, as skittish and timid as a fawn, was wearing white jeans, a purple sweater, and knee-high suede moccasins with fringe around the cuffs.
You left early this morning, but I got your note. What did you want to talk about?
He patted the bench, inviting her to sit. I have a few things to discuss and thought it would be nice to chat in our special place. Sophia sat beside him and studied his face with concern.
Are you okay? You haven't seemed like yourself lately.
Aidan could see in her emerald green eyes that she felt his distress, so he forced a smile. Nonsense. I'm fine. Clearly, she wasn't convinced.
What's wrong? I can tell something's bothering you.
You know me too well. He glanced at her apologetically. Once again, my work is taking center stage, and I'll be out of town on your birthday.
Is that all? You have me worried. Where are you going this time?
London. I'll be lecturing at a conference. The keynote speaker broke his hip, and they begged me to fill in at the last minute.
Then take me with you. I can finally use my passport, and it'll be the best birthday present ever.
Sorry, Angel. You know that's not possible. I never mix business with my personal affairs.
Can't you break your own rules once in a while?
No. Aidan softened his tone. Now, please, let's discuss something more pleasant, like your graduation present.
All right. What is it?
It's a secret. Meet me after class and I'll show you. Sophia was excited.
Did you finally buy me a VW Bug?
No, the car I gave you for your high school graduation is still in mint condition.
Okay, now I'm really curious.
I think you'll find it's worth the wait. Well, I must prepare for my lecture.
Can't wait to see what you have up your sleeve.
Sophia got up and walked away. When she was gone, Aidan closed his steel gray eyes, straining to conceal the inner turmoil behind his stoic demeanor. To still his mind, he took deep breaths and concentrated on relaxing every muscle in his body and slowing his heart rate. After a few minutes, the soothing sound of water flowing in the fountain calmed him, but his equanimity vanished when he heard a familiar gruff voice. "Hello, old friend," a man said. Recognizing the distinctive Irish accent, Aidan opened his eyes and scowled at the intruder sitting on the bench across from him. Jack McLaughlin wore the wry grin of a self-satisfied con man. His pale, freckled skin and icy blue eyes were chilling. Ginger hair, slicked back with pomade, crowned his broad, thick skull, while a fighter's physique bulged through his tight red shirt. Aidan had detested him for years, and although in his late 60s, he looked even more menacing than when he was younger. Jack, the time has come to fulfill your agreement, and the boss wanted to confirm you're still on track. Don't insult me. I'm quite clear about my responsibilities. Not so sure about that, Jack said. You've been unreliable in the past. You have no business being here. Actually, it is my business to keep an eye on you. Just saw your lovely daughter. She's a pretty young thing, almost as bewitching as the mother. Aiden lunged at Jack with lightning speed and hurled him to the ground. Sophia and Ella are off limits. Stay away from them or you'll regret it, he warned, looming over him. Unperturbed, Jack rose and dusted off his pants. He clenched Aiden's shoulder with his powerful hand and squinted at him with cold fury. If anyone else had done that, I'd slit their throat. Lucky for you, you're the boss's pet. Aiden shoved his hand aside. Tell him I'll be there. Now get the hell out of here. Be careful, mate. Stress leads to an early grave. Jack strolled away, whistling a carefree tune. Aiden followed him, then reconsidered and stopped dead in his tracks, his heart pounding. He was caught between two incompatible worlds, but the die was cast, and there was no turning back.
This is co-author Anthony Adams reading from a book that he and his wife wrote together, his wife Christina Adams. The title of the book is Chasing Shadows, and it's their debut novel that they've written together. It raises so many questions. Just in chapter one, we learned that what Sophia looks like. She's a willowy blonde. And when I read that, I flipped back to the cover. And I'm assuming, oh, that's what she looked like. How would you describe the cover of your book, by the way?
The cover of our book was something that we conceived of and spoke with the publisher about it. And they liked our concept, which was, we wanted the girl with her back to the camera, or, you know, not seeing her face, and headed into a dark alleyway or some place where she looked like she had no, you know, had no idea where she was going, which is basically where Sophia comes from during this book. She's a naive sort of sheltered girl, even though she comes from a divorced family. Her father has protected her and micromanaged her life. And then when he leaves, suddenly she's on her own. And that's what the cover of the picture was hoping to suggest, that this girl is on her own searching for the truth.
And a search that leads her to Boston, to Ireland, and to Italy, and a lot of mysterious locations there.
So we tried to make the cover look European.
My guests are co-authors Anthony and Christina Adams, and they have written a book, Chasing Shadows. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my two guests, co-authors Anthony and Christina Adams, and they've written a book based on Christina's real life, Chasing Shadows. You mentioned that you had to change some names. So, for example, the dad, Aiden, teaches at El Encanto College. There is an Encanto, Arizona, but there's no Encanto College. So that, I said, okay. She didn't want to name the college. But
no.
There's this villain, and he is just so, gosh, we just, already we don't like him. And I just wondered if there was such a villain. I'm sure his name wasn't Jack McLaughlin, but was there such a villain that you had to cope with, Christina?
No, that was actually, that's fiction. And the interesting thing about fiction is you can take things that are unanswerable in life and you can make sense of them. So we needed a villain for this story. And one of the puzzling things about my father is that we never really could know what happened to him. We had many doors slammed in our face. We searched and searched. We tried to get into various archives in the Vatican and other societies that, and it was impossible. And so I had to come to grips with the fact that I would never know what happened to him, what actually happened to him. But on some level, I think because he was such a great father and so supportive until he did this, it almost felt like one of the things that happened in real life was I did find out that my father had made a deal to come back. As I mentioned, he did meet my mother in Rome, and to come back to this, he belonged to a kind of secretive organization, an order within the Catholic Church, which I didn't know about. Of course, I didn't even know he was a priest. So there was a lot of things I didn't know.
But all this is the truth in your story that you're telling.
Yeah, that part. As I said, is true. But a lot of it had to be just fiction because a lot of what he did made no sense.
When he vanished, telling Christina and her sisters that he had a new life and could never see them again and not look for him, that had occurred right after we met, and it was very devastating for Christina and her sisters. And Christina and I decided to go on a search and find what we could about his life. We went to the university where he taught. We spoke to his colleagues, his students. He was a very respected scholar, and we were able to find out some things. His associate professor that he was very close with mentioned that he had said that he was raising money for the Irish Republican Army, which was pretty shocking.
Yeah.
As they're a terrorist group. This guy was a super dad, very respected, very above board. And in the university archives, we found articles that he had published. And we found places that he had visited and spoke and taught in different places around the world. So we went around and followed all those clues and met all the people we could, where we learned and finally came back and spoke with Christina's mother with what we discovered. And then she finally admitted that he was a priest when they met. She knew nothing about this covert society that he belonged to as well, but she didn't even know he was a priest. When they met, he was in an order that did not wear vestments, and he only admitted the truth about that on the plane to America, where he was going to bring her to start a new life and introduce her to his parents, who rejected him and her and said they would never, for, you know, failing in his duty. He had been chosen since childhood to become a priest, and they rejected him and said would never see him again unless he came to his proper responsibilities. And little by little, we found out that he did belong to a covert society within the Vatican. And that's where we started to find out some interesting things about that order. They've been around over 400 years.
It was like finding out little breadcrumbs. We followed all the breadcrumbs we could until there was no more information. And then we had to sit with it for, you know, many, many years. Because, of course, I didn't want to write about it. I didn't even want to talk about it. But then coming to realize that my father and my mother had a lot of secrets, and I began to understand them as human beings, not just as parents, and dealing with all of the pressures and conditioning of their families and their societies and their religion. And I actually felt compassion and love for them. And Anthony and I realized this was a really great story and that we could bring some light to what dogma can do to a family.
And just as in the book, when Sophia and Ella escape from the catacombs and return home, and they try to process what they've endured after their harrowing journey, they receive Aidan's obituary, and which leads to a very surprising twist. And this, too, was inspired by a true event in Christina's life.
In fact, all of what you've just been recounting, you, Anthony, and Christina, seemed so real that I was assuming that, yeah, this all sounds like this actually happened, that these were true events, what you've just been recounting. And I was somewhat amused, too. I thought it was realistic that Christina and her character, Sophia, goes in the office and the receptionist says, no, you can't get an appointment with this person. And so Sophia said, oh, what a pretty sweater you're wearing. Is that purple mohair? And I thought, yeah, I've known women who were very nice, and they would be told, no, you can't see Mr. Whoever it is in this office. And the more she would talk, they, oh, well, okay, I'll fit you in. So I suspect maybe that happened, too. You had to talk your way into.
We did. We did have to talk our way into several places. And as I said, several people wouldn't talk to us. So some of the scenes in there were like in the book when they're thrown out of the rectory in Ireland. That actually happened. Right. It didn't happen in Ireland, but it happened.
Well,
so yes, we did. We definitely plumbed experiences, life experiences, to make this book feel as real as it could. But, you know, as I said, there was things about my father's life that I would never be able to know.
Well,
and so we decided just to write a book inspired by true events. And it was very cathartic writing it. It was like family therapy for me, my sisters, and Anthony. And that's what I was saying is the beauty of fiction. You can make sense of things in life that don't make any sense at all.
Because Sophia asks herself a question, and I'm sure this must have arisen in your life. She's wondering, why did he do this to me?
Yes.
And why did he lie about his sister?
Yeah. We didn't know anything about his family. He told us he didn't have any family.
And even when the mother in the story, Sophia's mother, Ella, tells her daughter, don't search for him. You may not like what you find. And that must have occurred to you, too. I'm sure the things you discovered were shocking. I mean, they were shocking as a reader. I was shocked.
They were, yeah. It's true. They were.
Oh, my goodness. Well, let's skip over a few chapters. And chapter 6, and this is Sophia. And Christina, since this is Sophia's chapter pretty much, I'm going to ask you if you would read Home at Last.
Sure.
Might mention that, excuse me, go ahead. Well, I was going to say that if the name Gaia comes up, that's Sophia's horse that she mentioned earlier that you had. Okay.
Well, just to give you a little bit of intro for the chapter, Sophia's birthday present that was mentioned in the first reading was a beach cottage along with a deadline to move out of the family ranch and be on her own. So here's an excerpt.
And she didn't want to do that.
No, she didn't.
Here her dad's giving her a beach house and she says, but no, I don't want to move here. I want to keep living where I'm living, sharing space with you. I'm sharing a residence with you. And now I'm guessing maybe that's fictional. Is that?
That is fictional. Yeah. He didn't give me a beach house.
Okay, well, let's see.
So here's an excerpt from chapter 6, Home at Last. Sophia drove along a country road lined with jacaranda trees, ablaze with purple blossoms. The windows were down and the gentle breeze blew through her long golden hair. Beside her in the passenger seat sat a bag of groceries. As a special treat, she had brought the ingredients to make crab Benedict, a dish her father loved. She couldn't wait to see him and had a million things to discuss with him. Although he frequently traveled abroad for work, this time felt different. After her mother moved out when Sophia was 11, Maria from Hilltop Stables would come and stay at the ranch to look after her. But now she was truly on her own, and to her surprise, it felt good to be independent. Sophia turned on the car radio, and one of her favorite songs, Home at Last by Steely Dan, was playing. She sang along while driving down the winding road to her childhood home, and a wave of nostalgia washed over her when she arrived at the ranch and parked on the gravel path in front of the house. Most of Sophia's memories were from here, and they would always hold a singular place in her heart. Grabbing the sack of groceries, she walked to the porch, unlocked the door, and quietly entered. She stepped into the dark living room and then opened the drapes. Her stomach dropped as she gaped at the empty room in disbelief. All the furniture had vanished. She hurried into the kitchen, put her bag on the table, and looked around. All the counters were bare. No butcher block knife set, no toaster, no coffee machine, no recipe books. The drawers and cabinets were empty with no silverware or plates. And the refrigerator, which was normally bursting at the seams with a variety of food and drink, had been cleared out. A shiver ran down her spine. "Dad?" she called and rushed down the hallway. She threw open his bedroom door and stared at the barren room. There was no furniture, no clothes in the closet, nothing. Fear gripped her. "Hello, Dad?" Her voice echoed in the empty house as she searched the rest of the rooms. Unrelenting panic seized her when she realized her father was nowhere to be found. Stripped of all its personal belongings, the property seemed strangely unfamiliar, as if their lives and memories had been scrubbed from the premises. She trembled, and tears ran down her face. Sophia hurried outside and saw the porch swing rocking eerily back and forth in the wind, as if the ghost of Aiden's was haunting his favorite spot. "Dad, where are you?" she whispered to herself. Frantically, she ran to the barn, her heart pounding, hardly able to believe what was happening. She unlocked the door and stepped inside. The empty barn, which used to be one of her most cherished places, seemed cold and lifeless. She felt trapped in a living nightmare. Through her tears, she saw a duffel bag inside Gaia's stall. She slid open the zipper and discovered it was stuffed with numerous rolls of crisp $100 bills. Sophia looked up and spotted an envelope with her name on it and Aiden's handwriting pinned to the back wall of Gaia's stall. She took it down and read the note silently, her hands shaking.
"Dearest Sophia, I knew you would come to see Gaia and wanted to make sure you'd find this note. I'm sorry my departure was so sudden, but it was unavoidable. Unfortunately, I can't explain why I left in a way you would understand. All my personal and business affairs are in order, and your horse is being taken care of at Hilltop Stables. The cash in the duffel bag should tide you over for a few years until you establish your career. Please forgive me for any sorrow this may cause you. My actions are irreversible, so don't try to find me. I have a new life now and must never see you again. Hopefully, you will learn to be at peace with my decision. I will always love you, and although she won't believe it, I love your mother too. Tell her I regret all the bitterness between us. Your ever well-wisher, Dad."
Sophia's mind reeled, and her legs could no longer hold her upright. Overcome by nausea, she collapsed on the ground and vomited. Racked with chills and vertigo, she tried to get up, but everything went black, and she passed out.
This is Christina Adams and her husband, Anthony Adams. They write under the one name, A.C. Adams, and this is their debut novel, Chasing Shadows. And there's so much in your book that piqued my interest. For example, the mother in the story lived in San Diego and mentions Little Italy. And I never thought about that, but I thought, wow, if I go to San Diego, I want to go to Little Italy.
And it's a lovely neighborhood.
That's what the impression I got from the book.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to mention the fact that it starts out here in the United States, but here Ireland comes up. And your character has a fear of flying, Christina. Sophia is the character's story. And so how is she going to Boston is where they're going to go first. If she's going to go.
She goes to Boston first to try to figure out. She learns quite by accident that she has an aunt because she was always told her father's family was gone and they were all dead.
That was his lie. So that's why she didn't know he had a sister.
No, she didn't know he had a sister. And when she talks to one of his associate professors, the colleague that he works with at the college, he happens to let it slip that he met the sister. And so that's her first clue that she decides to follow and goes to Boston to try to confront.
She has an aunt, which she didn't know. Sophia didn't know she had an aunt. And so that's her first clue, and that's the first clue she chases, which takes her to Boston.
You know what? I found I was amused by the fact that she lands in Boston. She needs to rent a car. She goes to the rental car place. And you kind of drop a clue earlier in the book as to what kind of car she'd want to rent. And I was amused by the fact that, well, what car did your character rent?
She rented a VW Bug.
Because she earlier said she wanted one, and her dad said, no, you're not going to have one, and he gave a reason. And when my husband and I got married many years ago, I had a VW Bug that I loved. But you know why my husband wanted to get rid of it? Same reason Sophia's dad said, nope, it's not. It's
not unsafe,
yes.
Yep.
So, unsafe.
So,
because, unsafe at any speed.
But that's an example of how her dad controlled her, and here she's free to make her own decisions. So that's one of the decisions she makes.
It's like stepping up her independence by getting the car she wants.
Yes, that's what I consider an example of that. Well, something else she learns in Boston, that she was wrong about her dad's last name.
Yes.
What did she learn?
She learned that her dad had changed his name, but she finds that out from a friend. She finds, well, just a step back, she finds a satchel that her father accidentally, well, he had left it to be burned at the college.
In his office at the college, yes.
Correct. And then she rescues it out of the, practically out of the fire, and finds a postcard, which also leads her to Boston, of an old friend of his who calls himself, you know, your brother. And she thought, well, if he has a sister, maybe he has a brother. So she's chasing both of those leads.
But guys call each other brother when they aren't necessarily
exactly.
blood brothers. So she wasn't
right,
sure.
Right, but she didn't know. She wasn't sure, exactly. And so she chases that lead, too, which also leads her to Boston. And in that meeting with her father's old friend, high school friend, she discovers that his name used to be Malone. And that's another clue. So all the way through the book, you know, the little breadcrumbs they follow, kind of reminiscent of the little breadcrumbs Anthony and I followed when we were trying to figure out what was the story of my father.
So if her dad's original name was Malone and not Ryan, then Sophia was wrong about her last name. Now, I'm guessing maybe that is fictional?
That is fictional, yes, yeah.
But he hid the whole existence of his family, all of them. And
that is not fictional.
Yeah.
Completely true. Mm-hmm. And also in the obituary that happens with Ella and Sophia, Christina, you might mention the similarity to the real life incident and what you learned from the canon lawyer that was in there.
Well, what's really fascinating is that, as Anthony mentioned, it was actually just, we met right around the same time this was happening to our family. And I was kind of an emotional basket case at the time. And he decided he was going to help me figure out what the truth was. And my sisters were busy raising little kids. So I ended up volunteering to try to figure out what happened to Dad. But it was like about 3 years after he left, we received a obituary in the mail. And it said he had died. And in the obituary, it listed all the dignitaries that had attended the funeral. And it showed a picture of his headstone, which said, "Forever a priest." And so I started, my first step was to track down everybody that was listed there. And as luck would have it, I was one of the people I called after finding his phone number was the canon lawyer that arranged for my parents' divorce. And that was one little piece of the puzzle that dropped right into place because he explained to me that my father had agreed to return to his position in the society and in the church after his youngest child had come of age. And
so as soon as you graduated from college, he could return.
And he had agreed to return. And I said, so, but in the obituary, you said he was survived by his sister. And I said, but he had children. Why did you mention his children? And he said, in the eyes of the church, he was never married and never had any children.
So I think, as I recall, the person that mailed them this obituary was the friend who felt like they were brothers.
Yes, it in the book, that is what happened, but not what happened in real life.
Okay. After a break, Anthony and Christina Adams will be back to continue our conversation about their book, Chasing Shadows. It's based on the real life of Christina Adams and her search for her father. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my two guests, Christina and Anthony Adams, and they write under the one name, A.C. Adams, and their debut novel is Chasing Shadows. Well, something that appealed to me, because I've spent time in various cathedrals in France and Spain, and the feeling that she had, she went in this church, and I'm not Catholic, but I go in these places, and what she described, I thought, yes, that is, you walk in. Well, why did she go into this church, by the way, in Boston?
First of all, I think she was just so stressed out and upset that everything, I mean, the people that she thought she could count on, she was amazed that she had an aunt, and she got excited that that might be, you know, what she needed to find family again. This is before she had reconciled with her mother. And I think she was so stressed out that she just needed a quiet place to sit down and kind of gather her thoughts. That's why she went in the church in Boston. And as we pointed out, like in Italy, when Sophia and her mother Ella went to the Vatican and the various cathedrals there, Sophia came to realize, even though she was angry with what had happened, she came to realize that it's all about the art. And these things are pointing at the divine. They're not necessarily a manifestation of the divine, but they inspire you to become spiritual in a deeper way than any one religion can. And I, you know, that's why she went into that church. And she had a, she has a spiritual side. It's just not a religious side.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I've read surveys of college students when they say, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and you say in the book, Sophia found the music and environment peaceful and wiped the tears from her eyes. And I found that too, to go into, and sometimes there would be organ music playing in this cathedral, and it was really moving. Just like I didn't expect anything when I went to Lourdes, but it was moving.
It is very moving.
Yeah.
You walk in and this is, countless people have prayed there, countless people have meditated there, countless artists have put their energy and love into the architecture and the paintings and the sculptures.
Stained glass sculptures.
And the mosaics. And just, it's, we were just in France this year, and it's chillingly strong. And I think it's all that energy, all that positive energy poured into that space.
That's exactly the conclusion I have come to. Yeah, precisely. Well, so from Boston, she's got to fly again. Why does she go to Dublin, Ireland?
Well, one of the clues that she finds in that church in Boston when she talks to the priest is that there's a drawing in one of her father's notebooks, and that drawing is identical to a sculpture that she sees in that Boston cathedral. And then the priest that she speaks with there says that there's an inscription there. And the priest says that probably is referring to the Brotherhood of Archangels. So it's another clue for her to follow. And that's why she goes to Dublin, because he suggests that perhaps at Trinity College, she could find more about this kind of very arcane group that is little known, but that the Trinity College in Dublin has the best, you know, the library there has the best research materials, yes. And that might help her find something.
And that's what she says while she's going to Dublin. Well, while she's there too, she next wants to go to Roma, as her mother says it, Rome, and she wants her mother to go with her to Rome. And her mother, no, I don't want to do that. And one of the things that she says, Mom, why do you always let me down? And that's sad, because here are these two women that, well, anyway, so her mother does consent to go to Rome. So Sophia and Ella go to Rome. And at one point in the story, Ella says she believed God was punishing her for the sin of marrying a priest. Mm-hmm. And the other people are saying, no, that's not the case. And another question that Ella raises, why did I ignore all the signs of his dishonesty? And I think a lot of people reading that or wondering that would say, well, love is blind.
Love is blind. And, you know, I think people oftentimes, you know, will feel guilty about their actions, even though they really shouldn't feel guilty. A lot of people, if they get a divorce or they get, you know, a child that misbehaves, suddenly they take the blame themselves. And that was like what Ella did. She felt like, I failed. I did something wrong. It was wrong. Now God's punishing me because I did this terrible thing. Because you have to understand, she was raised a Catholic.
Oh, yeah.
And marrying a priest was a great sin. So, and that's actually the way my mother felt, too. So that's why she hid that information from her children until we were grown up. We had no idea he was a priest when they met.
My guests are co-authors, Anthony and Christina Adams. They write under the name A.C. Adams. And this is their debut novel, Chasing Shadows. And on the cover is this slender blonde walking down the street. And after we read that they go to Italy, that's in mind saying, oh, yep, there she's in Italy, right there on the cover.
Exactly.
So on a more pleasant note, how did these two meet? This priest who's not dressed like a priest, and how does he meet Ella?
Well, Aidan was raised in a Catholic family that chose him to be the priest, and he was dutifully behaving as he was told to. And he quickly rose in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church because he was very brilliant. And he spoke multiple languages. And so he was selected to this kind of more covert group within the Vatican. And as he had to do the things that he had to do, we surmise that this group is more of a political arm of the Vatican, because a lot of people don't realize the Vatican isn't just a religion, it's a city-state. It's actually a country that is independent of Italy and independent of any other government in the world. So they have they have the Vatican Bank, they have obviously they'll have a secret service as well, or a secret. So there's very few, as Anthony started to tell you, one of the things we discovered was the group that my father was in has been around. It was established by the Holy See around 400 years ago. And they only admit like very select number of priests per year. They have to be multilingual. And that particular order, they don't wear vestments. So we don't know much about them because obviously they're not going to share their archives with us. We tried.
We met a Jesuit priest in Montreal that shared a bit of information he knew, is that the people that are selected to join this order are released from their bishops and report directly to the Vatican. And he told us that only the members of the order have access to the details about the group and its mission, but they're bound by a vow of secrecy. And he also mentioned that he knew that when they are selected, they undergo a year-long process called The Solitude, the details of which he didn't know, we couldn't find. So when you see Aidan in the catacombs in Rome, in the society's catacombs, we invented our version of what we thought The Solitude might have been like.
So we feel, and that's how we wrote him, that Aidan, despite, you know, he was a good person, and despite all of the sort of pressures of society and family and church and religion, was ultimately very unhappy. So when he meets this young, carefree girl in Rome, he falls immediately in love with her.
He was 25 years older than Christina's mother.
Yeah. Do you know, there's a phrase that comes up, and this is Ella, and she says it in Italian when the two of them meet, solo amici. And why did she tell Aidan solo amici?
Means just friends.
Yeah.
And she was thinking, this is this older man. I'm not going to, don't have, she was, you know, suspicious of his intentions, but she wanted just to be friends. And
she was
unfortunately, she was young.
And Christina's mother told us that, you know, she thought she had finally met her soulmate when she met him.
Yeah. We got that impression as a reader.
And he obviously, at that point, we have to assume, was very disillusioned with his life as a priest and member of the society. And when he met her, she was selling flowers. Her family in Sicily had a flower orchards and sold flowers. And that's what she did, a flower shop in Rome. When she met this man, he was like a life raft to him. He fell in love and thought, another path for me. I don't want to be on the program path that my parents designed. I want to a wife and kids. So he immediately took her to the United States when they fell in love to have this new life. And then after the rejection of family, because of he was a brilliant professor with a PhD and a lot of scholarly papers, he very easily became an important position here at the university. And then that's how it happened. And the society did continue to come after him. And little by little, guilt got to him. Rejection by his family got to him. And then he decided that he would go back to that life.
Well, it started by the divorce. They got a divorce, and then he had to wait.
There's a phrase that Ella says, and she's only 24. I wish I had realized this when I was 24. She says, life is short. We must cherish every moment. So on that note, I want to thank you, Anthony and Christina Adams, for writing this book.
Thank you for having us on your program.
Thank you so much.
The title of their debut novel is Chasing Shadows, and they've written it under the name A.C. Adams. Thank you. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Will you lie down beside me? Will you lie down beside me and rest your weary mind and tired body? Will you lie down beside me and tell me the efforts and triumphs of your day? Will you let me hear of your defeats and sadnesses? I'll listen to whatever you have to say. Will you lie down beside me and let me recognize again and admire your beauty? Will you lie down beside me and let me run my fingers over your beautiful, silky skin? Will you lie down beside me and allow me to watch your wonderful grin? Will you tell me again about the travails of your wonderful, happy, and sad years? Will you lie down beside me and tell me all the places that you want to go and where you've been? Will you lie down beside me and let me gaze into your deep, brown, green, ever-changing eyes? Will you lie down beside me and tell me how I make you mad when I break your silly rules? Will you lie down beside me and look up into the blue sky and share with me your dreams? Will you lie down beside me and let me stroke gently the hair away from your eyes? Will you lie down beside me and let me speak softly the words I want to say? Will you lie down beside me and make me feel so strong in your special ways? Will you lie down beside me and let me feel your warmth, which seems to burn inside of you? Will you lie down beside me and let me be excited with your nearness? Will you lie down beside me and whisper your words of love to me? Will you lie down beside me and tell me how we will always be together or not? Will you lie down beside me and let the magnetism between us work its magic? Will you lie down beside me? Will you lie down beside me? Will you? Lie down beside me. Mark Malinger.
When she offered to read me her poems, the pages from which she read were ripped sheets of paper bags she'd stored in the woodshed, and I thought then, still do, that voice is a garden where we plant the believable. I'd sit next to her at the oak dining table, a light above us swinging on its umbilical cord, her voice holding Scottish ballads, the rhythm of her words wholly mesmerizing. Head cradled in hand, I'd incline closer to grandmother, who smelled of Sloan's liniment salve for arthritis, her red hair collapsing around her face, hands like weathered spotted leather. Why didn't I know then she had an expiration date, that soon after her last recitation of poems, her heart, too filled with reverence and memory, too filled with words about home in Nova Scotia, she would, days later, collapse to the linoleum floor, hand cupping her heart, mouth askew, unable to scream for help, unable to move, urine soaking her clothes. How long she lay there, unattended in the chill of my grandparents' home. Should I pretend death is the harsh reckoning of time, or a touch from angels, who may or may not have swooned over her poems? An axe stirs in desire's belly. I sharpen on longing. Diana Henning.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.